This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Israel has come to the rescue of a besieged Syrian aid organization. Robert Berger reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
The Israeli army evacuated some 800 civilians from Syria, most of them members of the White Helmet Civil Defense Group and their families. The military said their lives were endangered by advancing forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar Assad, who sees the White Helmets as collaborators with Syrian rebels. Israeli Cabinet Minister Tzachi Hanegbi described the rescue as a humanitarian gesture to the Syrian people and the international community. The operation was organized by the U.S., Britain, and Canada. They see the White Helmets as heroes.
Robert Berger reporting for VOA. And General Vincent Brooks, the commander of U.S. forces in Korea, has called North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's men of his word, while backing up assertions by other key officials that talks with Pyongyang are making progress. U.S. President Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have repeatedly expressed optimism about the ongoing talks with North Korea. However, Pompeo has expressed concerns about North Korea receiving shipments of petroleum, and he expressed those issues with the U.N.
The countries of the Security Council are united on the need for final, fully verified denuclearization of North Korea, as agreed to by Chairman Kim. Strict enforcement of sanctions is critical to our achieving this goal.
Meantime, Russia and China moved to block a U.S. request of the U.N. to ban further fuel shipments to Pyongyang in a bid to cut off revenue to its nuclear and ballistic missile programs. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Afghanistan hosted a new round of ongoing wide-ranging discussions with Pakistan Sunday in an effort to build mutual confidence and work together to bring an end to the Afghan conflict. The Kabul meeting took place under a framework agreement of bilateral engagement called the Afghanistan-Pakistan Action Plan for Peace and Solidarity. The process seeks enhanced military cooperation, intelligence sharing to jointly fight regional terrorism and promote Afghan peace and reconciliation efforts. Police in Pakistan say a suicide bombing in the country's northwest has killed the driver of an election candidate while wounding the candidate and three other people. It is the latest violence ahead of Wednesday's elections. No word right now on who's responsible. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have an issue with U.S. President Trump's claim in a tweet that newly released documents relating to the wiretapping of his one-time campaign advisor Carter Page confirm with little doubt that intelligence agencies misled the courts that approved the warrant. More from AP correspondent Shelley Adler.
Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff said the documents lay out in detail just why the FBI was so concerned that Carter Page might be acting as an agent of a foreign power.
The dumping of these documents with George Papadopoulos, that Carter Page had in fact been a target of Russian intelligence in the past, that Carter Page had gone to Russia during the campaign.
And Republican Senator Marco Rubio also broke with Trump, saying he didn't think the FBI did anything wrong in obtaining warrants against Page.
They were looking into this one individual, but an individual the campaign themselves said was not a big part of their efforts. Therefore, I wouldn't consider that spying on a campaign.
Rubio appeared on CBS's Face the Nation while Schiff was on ABC's This Week. Shelley Adler, Washington.
Scientists in Australia seem to have made a breakthrough in detecting melanoma in its early stages. Currently, skin examinations and biopsies are the most effective way to detect melanoma. But as VOA's Phil Mercer explains, a blood test developed by university researchers in Western Australia could help increase a patient's chances of survival.
Professor Mel Zeiman is the head of the Edith Cowan University Melanoma Research Group.
We're hoping that it will reduce the number of people that get metastatic disease, because that's where it becomes tricky. If a thin melanoma is identified early and it's removed, you have a 98 to 99% chance of 5 to 10-year survival. So that's what we're hoping to achieve, is that people will feel more comfortable going for skin checks. So it will just up the number of people that are aware and able to get their melanoma identified earlier.
Malignant melanoma is the most serious form of skin cancer. It's mainly caused by exposure to UV radiation.
Phil Mercer for VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
There are a number of political actors from across the board, across the regional divide, across the tribal divide. So this presents a national face that would really, really challenge the incumbency ruling political party at the moment.
Malawian Vice President forms a new party to challenge President Arthur Peter Mutharika in next year's elections.
All of them coming together, presidential aspirants. Who among them have the credibility, the integrity, and the acceptability like the incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari? I don't think so.
A former vice president declares his plans to become the next Nigerian president.
We are focusing, we have no fear, we're going to fight legally to get the Congo on a clear way for better elections. And we won't let President Kabila to seek a third term. That won't happen in the DRC.
And DRC President Joseph Kabila says elections will proceed as originally planned this year. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Malawian Vice President Saulos Chilima officially launched a new political party, the United Transformation Movement, in the capital Lilongwe Saturday. The vice president vowed to challenge incumbent President Arthur Peter Mutharika in next year's presidential election, promising to continue his push to remove presidential immunity from prosecution. The vice president said he will soon name corrupt officials in the government. For analysis on the new opposition political party, I read Vincent Kondwe, a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi.
There's a lot of excitement among the population. It reminds me of the period 1992-1993 when Malawi was transitioning from one-party rule to multi-party democracy. The mindset of the people and the general mentality of the nation is that people are in need of politics of renewal. People are in need of change that can translate into changing their welfare, their livelihoods, and the general economic development of the nation and the people. And the coming in of the United Transformation Movement, or let's call it United Transformation Party, is a brand that is presenting itself as that agent of that change and that renewal that the people are looking forward to. The launch of the UTM yesterday has shaken the traditional political party actors that we have known for the last 5 years or so.
I understand Calista Mutharika, the former first lady, has been a major proponent of this new party. What happened that there was a fallout between him and the current president? It appears to be a family feud going on here. What happened? Tell me.
Calista Mutharika, who was the former first lady and who is the sister-in-law to the current president, is the first person who came out in the open that the vice president, Saulos Chilima, should challenge the incumbent, Arthur Peter Mutharika, at the DPP convention. When you critically look at the genesis of this whole issue, you find that it began as a family feud where there are speculations that Calista Mutharika was probably not having enough influence to the core inner party of the DPP. Now, to protest against that lack of influence, she decided to support the vice president, and she came out in the open. However, as it has turned out, it has become a movement that is now wearing a national face and not necessarily only a family feud. So it is now a national movement, but the beginning of it all, it began as a family feud between President Peter Mutharika and former first lady, Calista Mutharika.
Saulos Chilima, the vice president, said he was going to name and shame people who he described as corrupt in the administration. He still remains the vice president, and he is threatening to name and shame. Why has it taken him this long? And will this damage the ruling party ahead of next year's election?
Different race going to damage the chances for the DPP for 2019 election. Because as of now, the national side has been looking to rally behind a Protestant movement that can protest against the lack of accountability. If you look very well, the problem of corruption in Malawi is a political problem because it is happening at the highest levels of government. And the people have no one to rally behind to challenge and bring to book or bring to account those that are indulging in corruption, that are indulging in the malpractices that are counter-developmental. So in this way, I find that Chilima is representing the majority of the people who want that those who are indulging in corruption, plunder of state resources, should be brought to book. And Chilima presents is the first of the majority of those people who want that those who are corrupt should be brought to book.
This new party launched Saturday appear to be attracting all kinds of support from politicians and members of parliament from different political parties where they might have been disgruntled or appear not to like what is happening there. Do you think that the party could pose a significant threat to President Arthur Peter Mutharika in next year's election?
If what happened yesterday is a litmus test of the popularity of the vice president, Dr. Saulos Klaus Chilima, is anything to go by. If it is a measure of what is to come the next 10 to 11 months, he presents a very serious challenge, not only to the ruling Peter Mutharika, but also the predominant opposition party, the Malawi Congress Party, which people thought would win the 2019 elections, given what is happening at the moment. Because when you look at what happened yesterday, there are a number of political actors from across the board, across the regional divide, across the tribal divide. So this presents a national face that would really, really challenge the incumbency ruling political party at the moment. And given what happened yesterday, I believe that the ruling DPP is thinking twice and having very sleepless nights over what happened yesterday in Lilongwe.
Vincent Kondwe is a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi. He spoke with me from Nzuzu in northern Malawi. Former Nigerian Vice President Atiku Abubakar has announced plans to seek the presidential nomination for the main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP. The former vice president recently returned to the opposition party. He previously left the PDP to join the All Progressive Congress, or APC, where he supported Muhammadu Buhari in the last presidential election. But the former vice president says growing insecurity, rising political tension, and high unemployment among the youth are the core reasons why he wants to become the next Nigerian president. For analysis, I reach Abdulrahman Balogun, assistant editor-in-chief with the News Agency of Nigeria in the capital, Abuja.
I don't think Nigerians are really surprised by the sudden declaration that former past president is coming up. Since 2003, he came out. 2007, he came out. 2011, he came out. And in 2018, Nigerians are used to him coming out declaring from one party to other party.
A few years ago, he threw his unflinching support for President Muhammadu Buhari. What changed?
The moment President Muhammadu Buhari declared early enough that he is going to recontest, I think he felt that the end of road for him, the party, because, of course, if you recollect vividly, in 2014, he contested the primary with Buhari and two other persons. He came third at the primary. So if Buhari now said he's going for second time this time around, I think he felt he cannot make it in APC, which is the party that is Buhari is leading, that he had to go back to his former party, PDP. What changed is not based on any principle. I think it's just the fact that he is looking for a platform to realize is a life ambition. It has been to become the president of the Federal Republic of Nigeria.
Some Nigerians say the former vice president appears to be too desperate to become the president, and that his fallout with former president Olusegun Obasanjo might have damaged him beyond repairs. And there were speculations that the former president has decided that as long as he lives, he will oppose Atiku Abubakar from becoming the president of Nigeria. What are your thoughts?
It will be true. Because if you recollect, in 2003 to 2007, former past president Atiku Abubakar, I think, went to court 16 times to challenge all cases of corruption, abuse of power, what I do that was levied against him. And it was after he cleared himself of all form of indictment that he now came out to say that he was contesting. And the former president was reported to have said that he would not allow him. But the former president is no longer there now. I mean, sometimes 4 years ago, he said he quit partisanship. He called his CDP card that will never be a member of any political party again. So I don't see how that will play out now. I would not want to say that he's desperate. I would only want to say that he's ambitious.
There are speculations that the strong alliance of major political parties teaming up with the PDP ahead of next year's election could pose a significant threat to President Muhammadu Buhari's re-election ambitions. Do you foresee that happening?
The coalition is not going to pose any threat to the ambition of President Muhammadu Buhari. Barely 24 hours after the claim that they are forming a coalition, 20 political parties came out to tell the whole world that they are not part of it, they are not contacted. And then later we learned that they are being coerced by somebody to form the coalition. I don't see it as a threat. Secondly, most of those people who have formed the coalition, especially the proponents, they are also ambitious. You can see some of them as presidential aspirants in their own right. So I don't know how they want to bury their ambition and present one candidate. If you recollect, in 2011, the then CPC and AC tried to form a coalition against CPT. But because of, I think, disagreement on who to be the flag bearer, they couldn't make it. But in 2014, they came together and harmonized and decided that Buhari would take it. And then Buhari got it. So these same people that are just come under court, coalition of political parties, I don't see them coming together and say, okay, this is the anointed candidate that they are flying for now. Everybody is flying. You have so many of them, all of them, so many of them coming together. They are presidential aspirants. Who among them have the credibility, the integrity, and the acceptability like the incumbent president, Muhammadu Buhari? I don't think so.
Abraham Balogun is an assistant editor-in-chief with the News Agency of Nigeria. He spoke with me from Abuja. Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila says the country's election scheduled for December 23 will proceed as announced by the Independent Electoral Commission. The president's speech to the National Assembly and Senate came as opposition groups expressed concern that he could seek additional terms. For reaction to the president's speech, I reach Abraham Luakabwanga, National Secretary in charge of communication for the main opposition Union for Democracy and Social Progress, or UDPS.
We, Rassemblement, but also Congolese people, we were expecting Kabila to talk about his political future. Means that he's not going to seek for a third term. This has to be clearly said by President Kabila so we can have, you know, a clear way to go to the elections. But instead of saying so, he spent almost 50 minutes talking about what he did in the DRC during almost 15 or 16 years, And this is not what we were waiting for. Even though when he was giving us some figures of his so-called realization, they were wrong. The international community, through the Union Nation, asked him for more realization in terms of putting in place what we did agree, which is called the Accord of the Senko.
His officials are saying that DRC would have credible elections this year. Shouldn't this be a comfort to all political parties in the country, particularly Rassemblement, because this is what you've been fighting for?
But, sir, we've been fighting for peaceful elections. We were fighting for the return of people such as Moïse Katumbi to get back into the Congo. We were fighting to get those who are in prison, such as Eugene Diomi, Jean-Claude Muyambo, and all those people that were jailed just for political reasons. We were fighting for the return to the classic way of voting, not the use of these voting machines that we don't know exactly what is instead. And also, we've been fighting for the removal of 10 million of fake people that are in the electoral file. Those are the clear way we've been asking for us to go to the election. But in the meantime, I can assure you that we have registered our candidates for the state elections, and we are going also to give the names of our candidates for the Senate and the Parliament. So while we're fighting, this time we won't say no to the elections.
Is the Rassemblement insisting that if President Kabila decides to contest in this year's election, then opposition parties will not participate in the election at all?
Exactly. If he wants to, you know, by force, without respecting the Constitution, if he wants to step in, I think this is going to lead the Rassemblement of the people of the Congo to use what we do call Article 64, which means we have to stop. And it's going to be a clear way to go on the streets and fight until we're going to remove President Kabila by legally, because it's one of our articles of the Constitution.
If that happens and he wins, then what is your next line of action? Because he will still remain in office, because you said you will not even go to court to challenge it, because now the Rassemblement insists that he is illegal despite the fact that he remains the president of the country.
My friend, let me tell you this. There is no justice in the Congo, because all the people in justice work for Kabila. So this is a dictatorship that has been put in place in the DRC. So the only way we may have to get our voice being heard is to go on the streets and relay and heard by the international community that can help us to change the course of the system in the DRC. Do you know that several times we try to protest, we try to organize sit-ins, and everything ends up by people being killed, people being jailed, and should we go back to that way to get the Congo in the real path? Yes, sir, I can tell you, we are focusing, we have no fear, we're going to fight legally to get the Congo on a clear way for better elections. And we won't let President Kabila to seek a third term. That won't happen in the DRC, let me tell you that.
Abraham Luakabwanga is the National Secretary in charge of communication for the DRC Main Opposition Union for Democracy and Social Progress, or UDPS. He spoke with me from the capital, Kinshasa. Zambian President Edgar Lungu has come under criticisms after declaring Thursday, July 26, a public holiday. This, he said, will enable citizens to vote in the upcoming Lusaka, mayoral and other local government elections. The president also said he will not be bothered by the criticisms, adding that he has the constitutional mandate to declare a public holiday.
The announcement came as the president campaigned for the ruling party's candidate for the Lusaka mayoral poll. But opposition and civil society groups say the national holiday is needless and unproductive. For more reaction, I read James Lukuku, leader of the opposition Republican Progressive Party, or RPP.
To be very, very straightforward, this decision that the president made is totally unacceptable. It's unnecessary and it's very, very irresponsible because you're going to understand that Zambia has got 100 districts and we only have by-elections that are going to take place in 8 storage districts. And most of these districts are just newly declared districts, very, very small districts that have got no strong bearing on the national affairs of this nation. Because of elections taking place in eight districts, we declare a national holiday. It's very, very irresponsible.
Why is it unacceptable? Is it because this will allow prospective voters to exercise their legitimate franchise as enshrined in the Zambian constitution? Because voter apathy could be cut down, as officials of the government say.
The Republic Constitution of Zambia provides for holidays to be declared during general elections. When we have got general elections, these are district elections whereby they don't even have a constitutional provision. Because if there was a constitutional provision for that one to be declared, the president was not even going to be declaring anything. It was going to be automatic. So it is just unacceptable, doesn't make any economic sense. Because this is a developing nation whereby we have got vast businesses, we have got smaller industries that are developing. And these people immediately have got their holiday. All the workers that are going to work on that particular day, they are going to ask for overtime allowances. So it is economically unviable. It's not making sense for all the businesses, and it's not making sense whatsoever to anybody that believes in production.
The president exercised his mandate as enshrined in the constitution to be able to declare a holiday or not. He exercised that. And then he's giving people the opportunity to go and vote. Yet you said it's unacceptable. They are questioning and that this is just politically motivated to undermine what the president is trying to do to give the Zambian the opportunity to go and cast their ballot. And they said this is not wrong.
Each and every district has got district leadership. We have got people that are in charge of these respective districts. What you could have done was these respective district administrators, civic leaders, the town clerks of these respective districts that are carrying out these elections, they could have solicited for time breaks from the central government so that just these respective districts, they are the ones that should experience that daybreak whereby people are supposed to be allowed to go and vote. There is no a single by-election that is going to take place on the Copper Belt. And the Copper Belt is the engine of this nation because of the mining activities. So honestly speaking, even if the president has got those prerogatives, even when you have got power vested in your responsibility, it's better you use them responsibly. Why is the Copper Belt going to be resting on a day when there is no election that is going to take place on the Copper Belt and other districts going to just be there doing nothing on the 26th of July? Because these are going to have no activities whatsoever taking place in these respective districts.
What is your party going to do about this? What is your next line of action regarding this?
I have written a letter. We have done a letter to advise the president to tell him that it's not too late for him to rescind that irresponsible decision. 26th, it is still, we have got some 5 days before that. The president should listen to so many intelligent people of our republic that have seen nothing in his perpetuity of declaration of meaningless holidays. Time is still there, the president can rescind. Let him swallow his shame, let him swallow his responsibility, and just rescind that decision, which is not in this nation. So, as Republican Progressive Party, as party president and the secretary general of the Republican Progressive Party, we have done a letter to State House to ask the president to rescind that decision because it's not economically viable for a nation, smaller economy like Zambia.
James Lukuku is the leader of the Zambian Opposition Republican Progressive Party, or RPP. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa extended a hand of reconciliation Saturday to whites and ruled out more invasions of their land. For VOA, Sebastian Mhofu reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
In a sharp departure from his ruling ZANU-PF party, which used to treat whites as foreigners and seized land under Robert Mugabe's regime, President Emmerson Mnangagwa appealed to whites to vote for him in Zimbabwe's July 30th general elections and promised them land.
And we are saying many of our, especially white commercial farmers who remained but did not go away, we are very grateful for accepting this change. And they must come on board, and they must be issued with the 99 leases wherever the piece of land which they hold. And as we go forward, we are acquiring so much land that is now getting revealed as a result of the exercise we are doing now from those who had acquired multiple farms. And again, we are racially blind. Doesn't matter whether it is Chiwenga, if Chiwenga has a farm bigger than what is required in the area, we downsize it. We forget that he is vice president. He is a citizen like anybody else. The same with me and the same with everybody. We are going to make sure we don't have the animal farm mentality which you did this morning.
Mnangagwa was speaking at what his ZANU-PF party called a white interface rally to garner votes from the race about whom his predecessor Mugabe used to say, quote, the only good ones are the dead ones, unquote. President Mnangagwa now wants their vote in the July 30th election, in which he locks horns with Nelson Chamisa of the main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change Alliance, along with other candidates for Zimbabwe's number one job. On Saturday, Mnangagwa said whites now would be eligible to get a 99-year lease for land. Mugabe's regime seized most of the white-owned land in the early 2000s in what he said was land reform meant to address colonial imbalances. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Kenya's Gor Mahia recorded a big win in the group stage of Africa's Confederation Cup, beating Tanzania's Young Africans 4-0 on Wednesday night. The victory puts them second in Group D at the midway stage, with a good chance of making the quarterfinals. It's the first time that Gor has competed in the group phase of Africa's second-tier club competition. USM Alger of Algeria topped the pool after coming from behind to beat Rwanda's Rayon Sports 2-1. So, the group standings are as follows. In Group A, ASEC Mimosa of Ivory Coast drew with Raja Casablanca of Morocco. Aduana of Ghana beat AS Vita Club of DR Congo 2-1. In Group B, Renaissance Bakane of Morocco drew with Al Masri of Egypt, while Al Hilal of Sudan drew with UD Songo of Mozambique 2-2. In Group C, Enyimba of Nigeria beat Williamsville of Ivory Coast 1-0, while Joliba of Mali beat CARA of Congo 2-0. In Group D, Rayon Sports of Rwanda lost 1-2 to USM Alger of Algeria, while Gor Mahia of Kenya thrashed Young Africans of Tanzania 4-0. Meanwhile, the resumption of Nigeria's domestic league has been postponed indefinitely amid a leadership crisis currently rocking the country's football. Chris Giwa, founder of a rival faction in the Nigerian Football Federation, armed with a court ruling from 2014, is now claiming to control the governing body. His assertion comes despite serving a ban imposed by football's world governing body, FIFA, who recognized Amaju Pinnick as NFF president. Domestic football was due to resume on July 18th after taking a break while the World Cup took place. And the winner of this year's African Champions League will be given direct entry into the group phase of the next edition of the competition in a bid by the Confederation of African Football, CAF, to alleviate fixture congestion. CAF General Secretary Fahmy says this decision is a one-off and applies only to the 2018 Champions League because of changes to the timing of the annual continental club competition. This year's Champions League and African Confederation Cup are the last to be staged within a calendar year. It ends some 5 decades of a traditional February start and culminating in an end-of-the-year finish. The next editions will mark the change in dates as decided by CAF after overwhelming suggestions at last year's CAF symposium in Rabat. Future Champions League and Confederation Cup competitions will be staged from August through to May, following the same schedule as most of the major African leagues and also that of the European club competitions. And in boxing, world heavyweight boxing champion Anthony Joshua fights Russia's Alexander Povetkin on September 22nd at Wembley Stadium before hopefully facing WBC champion Deontay Wilder. Britain's Anthony Joshua is the current WBA, IBF and WBO title holder. And at 38, the Russian is 10 years older than Joshua and fought for the same 3 titles when suffering his only defeat by Vladimir Klitschko in 2013. That was the same time Joshua made his professional debut, stopping Emanuele Leo in the first round. And finally, in rugby, England women have been knocked out of the main competition at the Rugby World Cup Sevens, beaten 19-14 by Ireland. Defeat saw England going into the challenge competition, where they beat Mexico 59-0 in the quarterfinals, with the winners of that tournament placing 9th overall in San Francisco. Ireland lost 45-0 to New Zealand in the championship's quarterfinals and will now play Russia in the 5-8 place match. England and Scotland's men are both into the championship quarterfinals. Scotland will play South Africa in the last 8, where England will face the USA. While both England and Scotland are guaranteed a top 8 finish in San Francisco, Wales and Ireland will now do battle for a 9th place finish at the best. Both enjoyed a promising start to play on Friday as Wales defeated Zimbabwe 33-12 and Ireland beat Chile 17-12, progressed from the qualifiers that determined the last 16. But their tilts at the championship title ended there with heavy defeats, with Wales failing to get a score on board in a 35-0 defeat by the USA, while Ireland lost 45-7 to South Africa. Wales will play Samoa in the Challenge quarterfinals as Ireland come up against Kenya. And that's it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Yo, yo,
miro miro.
Wata.
Nange miro miro.
Wata.
Oh yeah yeah yeah. My baby you take me so high. Oh yeah. Simbarara. You make me dance. Kumbaya. Mira. Baby, you turn down the soda. You swagging, shaking your shoulder. And you know, I enjoy your presence, you know. You know, you know. Ay, 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 ay. Go by one and funes on you. Go by one and zira mazika. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
Baby, Kea. Baby super, la sitima ye guanja kira. Baby kaya, baby super, waka bitu ni ingala.
Yo yo, kunja chirenku.
Yo yo,
kundanga kapiro.
Yo yo,
kuntana miro miro.
Wata,
unange miro miro.
Wata,
kunja chirenku.
Yo yo,
kundanga kapiro.
Yo yo,
kuntana miro miro.
Wata,
unange miro miro.
Wata,
oh yeah yeah yeah, my baby you take me so high. Soldier, you're my woman strong, heater in the winter.
Wata, wata, wata,
dangerous.
Wata,
in the case of dangerous,
wata. Yeah.
She who are dangerous,
wata,
shall much who say,
wata.
Minaj. Anytime she turn around, she got me over. I see the back, I know the doubt. The headlight, the steady flash. Mama, give me that, kitty cat. You turn me into a dog. I say, wait, you must become my lady. Oh, yeah, you drive me crazy. Yeah, I can't explain this feeling. See, yeah, my Soweto, baby. Baby girl, you give me fire. Girl, your body gets fire. Girl, you give me the fire. Girl, your body gets fire. We call on the pass on my lover. The way you shaking and yet, baby girl, you give me fire. Girl, your body gets fire. Girl, you give me the fire. Girl, your body gets fire.
I got one. Numbers on the above. You must become my lady. Oh, yeah, you drive me crazy. Yeah, I can't explain this feeling. See, yeah, my Soweto, baby. Soweto,
yeah.
Call
on the pass of my lover. The way you shaking and yet, baby, girl, you give me fire.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. This could be regarded as China's week in Africa, although some are suggesting that the visit of the Chinese president represents a reaffirmation of China's hold over the continent. Since Xi Jinping was unanimously reappointed China's president in March this year, this is the first foreign trip he is undertaking. He arrived in Jakarta yesterday afternoon after a three-day visit to the United Arab Emirates, a major commercial and transshipping hub in the Gulf. And in Senegal, President Xi hopes to strengthen the relationship between the two countries since Senegal in 2005 established diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China. already there are many cultural and infrastructure developments sponsored by China in Senegal, and many Senegalese and their governments are very enthusiastic about this visit, and they hope that a great deal will come out of it. From Senegal, President Xi will travel to Rwanda, where again there are strong economic, commercial, and cultural ties between the two countries. It is expected that during the visit, President Xi will sign with the president of Rwanda significant bilateral agreements. In addition, the president of Rwanda will host a meeting involving China, Mozambique, and India. And from Rwanda, President Xi will pay an official visit to South Africa commencing on the 24th. This will be the third visit of President Xi to South Africa, indicating its very close commercial, economic, and cultural relationship with South Africa. And following the visit, the official visit, China, along with the other BRICS countries, such as Brazil, India, Russia, and South Africa, will hold the 10th meeting of the BRICS countries, South Africa being the only African member of BRICS. The BRICS countries have been intensifying their economic and trade relations, and there now exists a development bank of BRICS, which is assisting its members and others in major infrastructural developments. It is important to put in context that this BRICS meeting will be held at a time when the international community is confronted with a severe trade war due to the imposition of tariffs by President Trump. Already, South Africa has become a victim of these tariffs because the tariffs on aluminium and steel is hitting hard on South Africa because South Africa was not exempted by the United States. So this will be a matter that will be discussed in the BRICS summit, and many will be examining carefully what decisions are taken by the BRICS countries. President Xi will conclude his visit to the African continent by a visit to Mauritius, which also has a very strong commercial relationship with China. It should be observed that although China is extending its hand to many other parts of the world in terms of trade and economic development, such as the EU and other Asian countries, its collaboration with Africa is very strategic. The reason being that China considers the African continent a reliable partner, and its infrastructural projects in many parts of Africa, particularly in East Africa, is an indication that China hopes for a long-term relations with the African continent. It has been pointed out previously that China now has established on Djibouti soil a base for logistics, and only recently announced plans for a free trade zone also in Djibouti. So this is a growing relations and shows that China, faced with a trade war, may want to rely on Africa as a partner. And Africa itself now enjoys a very fruitful relations with China and hopes that will continue. So for the entire continent, this visit of President Xi should be welcomed. Thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdun, and engineer for today, the ever-friendly Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the man who has bread to eat does not appreciate the severity of a famine. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As part of the U.S. government's support for a reconciled and unified Sri Lanka, the U.S. Defense Department's U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, or Indo-PACOM, has renovated two schools in the eastern province. Participating in the official ribbon-cutting ceremonies earlier this month were, for the United States, Captain Robert Holbrook of PACOM and Public Affairs Officer James Russo, while Sri Lanka was represented by Deputy Minister of National Integration, Reconciliation and Official Languages, Ali Zahir Mulana, Coordinating Secretary for Deputy Health Minister Zarjun Abubakar, and Zonal Director of Education Ahmad Junaid. PACOM funded the renovation of the Kava Thamune Al-Amin School, which cost over $308,000. This gift from the people of the United States of America to the people of Sri Lanka includes the renovation of a classroom building and the construction of an emergency kitchen, a 10,000-liter rainwater harvesting system, and a handicapped accessible bathroom. PACOM also contributed $272,174 for the renovation of the Abdul Kader School. This project also renovated a classroom building and constructed an emergency kitchen, a 10,000-liter rainwater harvesting system, and a handicapped accessible bathroom. Both renovation projects will improve the learning environment of the students while providing the community with a designated safe haven during times of emergency. PACOM selected these schools based on recommendations from the Sri Lankan Eastern Province Ministry of Education and the Disaster Management Center. "It is an honor to be here in Badikaloa," said Mr. Russo. "This year, we are celebrating 70 years of U.S.-Sri Lankan partnership, and recall that on February 4, 1948, then-U.S. President Harry Truman was one of the first foreign leaders to recognize Sri Lankan independence. Since then, U.S. cooperation has amounted to more than $2 billion in developmental assistance. We are privileged to participate today with the Ministry of Education in the renovation of these important centers of learning," Mr. Russo said. "As all the hardworking teachers well know, education is the key that opens the golden door of opportunity."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.